All right, go ahead.
All right, from Olivia Durth. Shabbat Shalom, Rabbi. Can we have righteous anger? Can you give me an example of what would look like for us to have?
Would you like me to give you some? I mean, is that what you're asking?
Can you give an example of what would look like for us that are covenanted?
Okay. Anger is a very challenging word, okay? Because I think we use that word for lots of varieties of strong or semi-strong negative emotions, okay? I mean, you could be disappointed. That could be a level of anger. You could be, have your feelings hurt. That might generate some anger. You could be frustrated. Certainly, that's my biggest area of anger, right? So I don't know that it really is good to say it that way. So can we have righteous? I think you could have a righteous or correct, meaning right, level of negative emotion to something if it is properly founded in reality and truth, okay? There are things that will absolutely go wrong in your life and you may be upset by them to some degree or another. And it would be right to at least be upset for at least a period of time. And the level of upset, of course, may not be right. So that's where that whole thing about it being righteous anger, you know, what does that look like is a great question. Okay, something happens in your life that is definitely not appropriate, wrong in some way, whatever. You know, you can certainly be disappointed, frustrated, or upset that it happened. You may also have to accept that you had no control over it, or you may recognize that you do have some control over it, so then you can focus on what you could do next time and do something better, okay? But when you talk about can we have righteous anger, yeah, I think we could be angry and we could be right. But the question is, and by the way, that's not when you're arguing with your spouse. Don't bring that in, well, I'm right and I'm angry and it's righteous anger and whatever, okay? All right. But just understand that he gave us this range of emotions to feel them. And it is right to feel every one of them sometimes. Sometimes we feel them in places they don't belong. We love things we shouldn't love. We hate things we shouldn't hate. We get angry about things we shouldn't get angry about. We get excited about things we shouldn't get excited about. Okay? And so that's part of the problem. So you have to then bring, you ready for this? The emotions down here, we got to bring this into play. And we have to ask, is what I'm feeling appropriate, rational to what I'm experiencing? Okay? And that's where you can start to figure out if it's right. The best way to figure out also is to ask somebody like me, you know, call here, talk to one of the leaders and say, look, I'm in this situation. Is it appropriate for me to be angry about it? And the answer may be yes. But then it's not someplace you stay. You don't stay in that anger, all right? Because anger, actually, you know what? Every emotion, to some level or another, motivates you. Some of them motivate you to do nothing, like they demotivate you, but it's really still motivating you to do nothing, all right? So they're stimulus or stimuli to get you to do something, even if that something is shutting down, okay? And so whether it's a positive emotion or a negative emotion, they kind of drive us. And so you have to be up here using this part, the thinking rational part of you, to decide whether or not that emotion should be driving. Now, it's not that it shouldn't be experienced, okay? You're going to experience all of them, the full range of emotion. You're going to be sad, you're going to be happy, you're going to be joyful, you're going to be angry, you're going to be bitter, you're going to be forgiving and compassionate, and there's a wide range of everything, loving, hating, whatever. You're going to cover all of that. But you have to then ask, is it appropriate? And you know what? That may need guidance. Because you know what? Let's say your whole life you've only experienced people using a certain emotion in an inappropriate way, you're naturally going to think it's appropriate because that's all you've ever seen. So it doesn't make sense to you that that's not the right way to react to something when that's what you've seen other people reacting that way to, right? So you may need to get counsel and say, hey, is this the right way to handle this? So, you know, just keep that in mind when you're dealing with this kind of thing, that the emotion has to be under the guidance and leadership of the intellect. Notice I didn't say you shouldn't have the emotion. But the intellect has to come in. There are times, I'm going to admit for myself, there are times that I'm angry about something, and I have to ask myself, what in the world are you angry about? This is dumb for you to get angry over this. By the way, that doesn't instantaneously deactivate the anger. It takes effort, okay, to go from recognizing there's no reason to be angry to stop being angry, okay? Or sometimes you get overly excited about something. What am I so excited about that for? That's dumb. There's no reason to be that excited about this dumb thing, okay? Maybe a couple of levels down, still excited, but not quite on that level. So it's learning the appropriate, and it's not just societally appropriate, and it's not necessarily just scripturally appropriate, the appropriate level for you to function properly, okay? And that means interacting with everybody else around you. Your level of whatever emotion may not be very well pleasing to interact with. Okay? Even if it's a positive one, it may just be a little annoying and irritating and over the top. If it's a negative one, you're bringing everybody around you down and it's irritating on that level, right? So there's learning he's called us to be a community, which means there are going to be people together living forever together. We should understand appropriately how our emotions should come into play because the emotions are what drive the action, all right? Remember I taught you this, right? We have an idea, a thought, something comes into our mind, nothing happens. If we hold that thought long enough, an emotion gets attached to it. If the emotion is strong enough, it leads to an action. If the emotion is not that strong, you may need to have that same thought multiple times, that same emotion multiple times, then eventually it leads to an action. Okay? Depending how strong it is. You know, we use the same idea, for example, when we talk about, you know, a man or a woman cheating, right? They may see somebody that's attractive and their mind goes, wow, that's a pretty person or a good-looking guy. And the emotion is, I know, but I'm not going to get too excited about that because I'm married. I don't need to be doing that, right? And so let's say they keep having that same thought and keep, you know, meditating on that, more emotion will get attached, then likely something will happen. Or at least an attempt to do something will happen, right? To at least interact, to try to pursue or something. Now, let's say the person had a strong reaction the first time. Well, then an action may happen much quicker. But the thought leads to nothing until emotion gets attached to it. Emotion could be simply, I want or I don't want, right? I like, I don't like. That's still an emotional response. It's not an intellectual response. It's an emotional. It's a feeling. Okay, it is what it is, and I feel about it, I like it. I feel about it, I don't like it. I feel about it, I want it. I feel about it, I don't want it. Okay, I feel about it, it's wrong, it's right. From a feeling point of view, because intellectually you may think it's one thing and you may feel very differently. Your brain says, that's wrong. Your heart says, oh no, I want that. Nothing wrong with that. Or vice versa. Your brain goes, that's right. And your body goes, oh, no, no. My emotion says, I don't want to do that. That's not, no, nope. Okay? So just kind of keep that in mind. It's a great question. It is the most challenging thing that flesh people have to deal with. Okay? It is the most challenging. In the flesh, dealing with our emotions is the number one biggest. Don't blame Hasatan. Don't blame this. Your emotions are your problem. And your inability to keep them from driving everything all recklessly. But you should be guiding it. You should have a governor guiding in your mind, guiding the energy to drive in a direction. Okay, you need to have that governing intellect there. So a lot of times people come to counsel. I say, look, your problem is you're driving here and not enough here. Okay? And so that's where you get in all kinds of mess because it's out of balance. It's out of balance. And so you have to recognize that. Okay, you have to recognize that. Okay, now, you can go to Tommy, which is where we tried to go originally, in Odessa, and then we'll go to Olivier. Say something, Tommy. Well.
Shabbat shalom, Rabbi.
Hey! All right, Shabbat shalom.
But, I have a question, mainly a connection that I'd like to make from the Torah study from last night. It's where it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart and won't let the people go. And then later on it says also that his heart was strengthened by Yahweh. Some people would say, well, why is, if Pharaoh wanted to let him go after a certain plague, I think it was the hail, he wanted to let him go. Yesterday, it was said that it's because he panicked, and at that moment, he wanted to let him go, but he really didn't want to let him go. I understand that point. But is it not about the intrinsic spirit that you had taught before, which Pharaoh's intrinsic spirit was power and dominance? So when Yahweh strengthened his heart, was he not strengthening that part of him so that he would not allow Israel to leave? And also the reason for him not wanting him to let him go yet was because, in a sense, he was, in that time, he was judging Egypt. It was time for the judgment of Egypt to come.
Right.
And he's using this opportunity to bring that the judgment unto Israel, Egypt, so that all will see that he is Yahweh and that he has power over all.
Okay.
Am I getting this properly?
Yes, actually, that's what I said last night. At least the second half of what you said is what I said last night. As far as the intrinsic nature thing that you were going to in the beginning of this, look, it doesn't say that Yahweh prevented him from doing what he wanted to do. And the Hebrew actually translates better, strengthened in the direction that he wanted to go, even though it says hardened. But the Hebrew has a better understanding there. And so when you look at it, think about the things that you do relationally, okay? Because I see this happen a lot in relationships. You're married or when you're dating somebody and all of a sudden something goes a little wrong and, you know, you're doing whatever it is you want to do and you're other person gets a little bit in your face and says, look, I'm done. I'm leaving. You're like, oh, no. I'll stop doing that. You have no intention of really stopping doing that, but you're panicked and so you're going to say whatever you have to say because you don't want them to leave. That's kind of like Pharaoh. Pharaoh's like, I'm afraid of the plagues. I'm really panicking. I have no interest in them leaving, but I just got hit with this horrible plague. My people got damaged and killed by this horrible plague and all these other things. And so I'm going to say, good, get out of here, go. So I think Yahweh was strengthening him in where he really was, which was that power dominant thing, which you said about his nature, and that Yahweh was basically strengthening him to say no, okay? Now, the other part about the plagues being to express Yahweh's judgments, I did say that last night, and the witness to the people as well as to Israel, which is why I said also that's why a mixed multitude came out, all right? Okay, Tommy, we're good?
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let's go to Olivier.
Shabbat shalom. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
You're good.
Oh, okay. All right. So I have a question related to tithing. My daughter Valentina, so at work, they have a program where they give you an award for your good grades at school. So I did tell her that that probably was not tithable, but I wanted to double check that with you.
Okay.
Especially this morning in the Zoom meeting, there were some questions about increase or not increase. So I'm not so sure anymore.
Okay, so this one's a little bit tricky. Okay, which is I guess is why you asked the question. It's a little bit tricky. All right. On the one hand, receiving a gift is not tithable. You can certainly make an offering if you're excited about the gift you got, but it's not a tithable thing because you didn't do any effort for the increase necessarily. Now, I mean, you just did good grades, which you would do for anyway, and you happen to get some sort of a gift. But if it's an incentive program from your employer to incentivize you because it's to the benefit of your job, that's where it gets a little tricky, okay? So I would still probably look at it as a gift. And you certainly can make an offering. I would still lean towards not tithable because it wasn't in your effort to make money that this happened. It was in your effort to get good grades, and you happened to get a benefit from that. Okay, you didn't get the good grades trying to get the reward. I mean, you were getting the good grades, and you happened to find out you could get a reward for that, okay? So I would say that it would be something that's not that you wouldn't tithe on it, but that you would make an offering if you wanted to. You don't have to do that either, but that's something you could do, okay? And I looked at your daughter, whose question it was when I answered that. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, because I was pretty sure about it before this morning, but then this morning there was a question about tithing on typing on the increase, so then it's become so clear for me what's an increase, what's not.
Okay.
I don't know if you have any
clarification. Okay. Look, let's be really clear about tithing, okay? Tithing is on an increase generated by an effort to generate an increase. Okay? It's an effort to generate money, you know, an increase. So if you're a farmer and you plant seed, that's an effort then to get a crop. If you go to work, you're going to work to get an increase. You invest into, you know, the stock market, or you invest into some sort of investment, and you're trying to get an increase. All right? Any effort to get an increase, whether it's your work directly, like in an employment situation where you have a job, or indirectly where you are investing in something, is still your effort to generate an increase. This question comes up a lot too when people get their retirement money, okay? So when you get your retirement money, it gets a little tricky because you have to figure out how much you put in. You also should be honest about whether or not you ever tithed on the money you put in. Because some people say, like, well, I already tithed on that. Well, you didn't start tithing till like last year, and your retirement money's been accumulating for 25 years. Don't tell me you've been tithing on all of that, okay? Because you never did. But as you take it out, look at how much you put in. Let's say over your lifetime you put in $100,000, but now the account is worth $200,000. Well, there's a $100,000 increase. But then this is where it gets more tricky. You're not taking all of it out at once. You're taking some out every month or every quarter or whatever you're doing. So my best recommendation is be generous with making offerings, because the math gymnastics to figure all that out is brutal, okay? So I'm not going to make you have to do that. But be generous, because it's an increase and it should be tithed. It's just very hard to tithe something you're not taking all out at once. Okay, so it's continuing to grow or go down, up and down, as the markets do, that the things, you know, a lot of times your retirement stuff's in some sort of a market, and then you're taking it out over time. So unless it's a fixed number, it's very hard to tithe on it. But you can make an offering similar to a tithe based on how you feel about the increase as you're taking it out. Okay, because I'd rather not have people come to me and ask me to do the accounting and math on it. Okay. Most of tithing is very simple, okay? You put in, and then you took out, and there was an increase. Or you worked, and then you got paid, there was an increase, okay? All right, so it's based on effort to generate increase. Okay, so you receive a gift, that's not an effort to generate increase. You do not tithe, unless you never tithe. You don't tithe on your tax refund, because you already tithed on that money. The government just got to hold it for a year or whatever. And now they're giving you it back. But if you had tithed on the money before it went in, now if you're tithing on the net, you didn't tithe on that. Okay? But if you tithed on the gross, like you should, then it's already been tithed on. You're just getting a refund back. Okay? Now maybe you want to use that refund to make an offering just because you want to use it in some way because you don't need it for other things. That's great. But it's not tithing. All right? If you're on government Social Security or whatever your government benefits are for, you know, being, you know, at the age of retirement and older, that's, again, it's an insurance program, it's a benefit, it's not necessarily an investment that you would tithe on. All right, now maybe you don't need all that the government gives. Good, make an offering out of some of it, all of it, whatever you don't need, that's fine. Okay, a lot of people do need a good chunk of it, and it's really not much to live on anyway. Funny thing is, I have more people on Social Security who make almost nothing on Social Security screaming about wanting to help and tithe more than I have people who have plenty of money that want to actually tithe. I mean, I actually have to argue with people not to tithe who shouldn't, because they're getting $800 a month from Social Security as a disability benefit, but they want to tithe. And they're mad that they can't tithe. I said, well, you can. You can give 10%. It's just, you can't call it a tithe. You can call it an offering, okay? But you don't need to do anything with that. Now, there are times during the year you have to make some offering. However little, it doesn't matter, but you have to make some offering, right? Deuteronomy 16:16, three times a year, you have to come and not come empty-handed, etc. So, you know, just, I know this tithing thing is it really is simple in general, okay? And I tried to cover most of this in the tithing teaching. You may just have to go back and listen to it more than once, okay? So it should be in there. All right. Before we go to the next one, let me read this thing that I want to read. So, Dell, you can hold on for a second. All right. So this morning in the zone two, and I thought this would be really good for all of you. This is a revelation, not end times. Don't get all excited. I'm revealing something to you. Okay. And it was great because this was brought up by a teenager, you know, who's just getting close to graduating high school. And I thought it was great. And the question was, how do you, and I said, this is something you're dealing with in high school. You're going to deal with this your whole life. How do you deal with being in the world and the pressures of outside influence? Okay. And I never answered it this way before. So I like the answer. So I want to share it with you. So first we need to understand in dealing with outside influencers or influences, we have to understand what we're influenced by. Three things. We're influenced by those we are impressed with or respect. Okay? We're impressed with them or we respect them. We admire them, right? Number two, we are influenced by those who we want to impress. So we shift on pleaser mode. We want to impress. We want to hear the praise from the one we want to impress. So they influence us much more easily. Then thirdly, we are influenced by those we fear. That's a very strong influence, the threat of something that makes you afraid, that you're afraid of a threat. You're afraid of disappointing, you're afraid of being punished, you're afraid of losing someone's love, you're afraid of something. I've had the biggest problem I've had of all of the people talking to me for 25 years about this stuff is walking in this walk, they're afraid if they don't go to this one's wedding or don't do this thing, somebody will cut them off, they'll lose something. Someone, really. Losing people is a big fear that causes an opportunity to be influenced. All right? What's the cure for that? Okay? The cure and the solution when it comes to the walk, not when it comes to being influenced in every other aspect of your life. But let's start with the walk. We should only be influenced by Yah and His anointeds. So you have Yahweh. Right, you got the Father, you got the Son, and then you got the anointed appointed. Why? Because these are the only ones that you should be impressed by, respect, and fear. If you could really do that, there would be very little possibility that outside will influence you. Think about it. You're influenced by the outside because you are in awe of them in some way, you overly respect them, or maybe properly even respect them in some areas, but not in this area, okay? So I'm not saying that, you know, necessarily you're impressed with people you shouldn't be impressed with. Some people are very impressive in their area of expertise or whatever it is. Do not let that mean that they should be influencing you in all areas, okay? I know some people I really respect their financial understanding. I may not want their health understanding. I certainly don't want their spiritual understanding. But I do want their financial understanding because I respect, you know, their accomplishments in that area, right? Well, when it comes to the vertical, to this walk, to your covenant, you're going to have all these potential influencers. As long as you're locked on really strong to saying, I only, which is why Yahweh says love Him with all, right? I only am going to be influenced by the Almighty, the Messiah, and the anointed appointed. Notice I didn't just say any rabbi, teacher, pastor, whatever. The anointed appointed. Okay? And that's, again, as always, you know, from Ephesians 4:11, you got to go find these guys. All right? Now, you don't have to find all of them and five different guys or four different guys. It's a fivefold ministry. Go find five of them. But find somebody that is anointed to then have a level of, a high level of respect and reverence and appreciation so that they're the ones who you're going to allow to influence because you respect that they're going to be in vertical alignment to the Father. Okay, this is really, really important. And it was great that a teenager, you know, asked the question, but it applies to all of you. Because you'll come to me all like, but my daughter won't talk to me. Oh, my mother won't talk to me. Why does that upset you so much? Again, let's go back to the first point about emotion and intellect. It's correct to be upset. What's with the level of upset? Okay? The level of upset is because you're still so impressed and wanting their honor. You want their respect. You want them to love you. You want from them when you should only want from Him. And if you switch that around, you'll be disappointed in your daughter or your mother or somebody not wanting to deal with you because they don't like your choice of your walk. But it won't matter as much because you're more worried about who you're going to disrespect if you let them influence you. Okay? And that's really what it comes down to. Because people will say things like, well, you know, he wants us to love, to, you know, families first, and about family, yes, his family first. All right? I think Isaiah said it when he came up, you know, when he was talking about, this is my family, right? And somebody else came up the same thing and said, there's blood family, and then there's my family. Uncle Chuck said that, right, okay? And if you get the right perspective, then you can understand the verses like when Yeshua said, you pick me. We may have a problem with a mother and a daughter and a father and a son and sister and a brother. Family members may have some issues. And you don't want that, but you accept that reality. And you will be upset about it to the level to which you have this balance right. If this balance is right, you will be minimally upset. But you will be upset because it's very sad and upsetting when your family, your blood family, doesn't appreciate and disrespects your choice of your walk. Nobody likes that. But then if you have this right, you sit there going, well, it is what it is. I'm sorry. But I'm not going to mess this up, the vertical up, because of you. Because you'll be upset. Okay? You know. Look, my family understands what we do, but they forget, and they're Jewish. Like, that shouldn't happen, but they're secular Jewish in general. And so whenever I would go up to New York and visit, my mother would try to schedule something on Saturday. I was like, Mom, it's Saturday. We're not doing that. And so, you know, after a while, though, of consistently doing that, now bear in mind my mother didn't get upset about it. She's very white-blue, and so she's not going to get upset. But the thing is, she, you know, eventually figured out with very sometimes occasional reminders, oh, by the way, that's on Saturday. She goes, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. You know, so you just have to hold the line and be consistent. Because you have to know, you open that door an inch and it's flying wide open. They're going to expect you to say yes to everything now. Oh, well, you went last time to so-and-so's wedding and you did this to so-and-so's thing and you did this. Same thing with your boss. You say yes to one Saturday, it's over. Don't ask for another holy day off. Don't ask for a Saturday off. You have opened up the floodgates, okay? All right? And why would you do that? Because you're fearing somebody other than him, or you're impressed with, or you want to impress somebody other than him. Did that help? Did that make any sense? Okay, I think that was a really powerful revelation. If you receive it and walk in it, okay? Remember, that's how revelation works. It's information. You got to receive it. And then walk in it. All right, now let's go to, let's see. I did tell Del we'd get to him next, so let's get Del Taylor on here now.
In James 1:5 says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of Elohim, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it shall be given to him. Preceding that verse, it says, in verse 2, it says, my brothers, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the proving of your belief works endurance, and let endurance have a perfect work, so that you be perfect and complete, lacking in naught. And then verse 5 says, if we lack wisdom. So what are we really asking for if when we ask for wisdom? Are we asking for life experiences or understanding, or the understanding through life experiences, or the understanding of those life experiences?
Probably all of the above. Look, I like that you're trying to follow the flow, right? The context. So you have, my brother's kind of joy in the trials. You should know that it proves your belief and works endurance. He's saying this. However, if you don't understand all that, ask for wisdom so you can see how it does that. He's not just saying, in general in life, ask for wisdom. Although you should, and you could, and I'm sure that Solomon says that quite a bit in Proverbs, okay? But here it's specifically talking about wisdom and understanding this specific problem. He says, endurance is going to have a perfect work so that you can be perfect and complete. If you don't understand all that, ask for wisdom. Wisdom so that you understand these things and then take full value out of it, make full benefit out of it, okay? Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't ask for wisdom in everything. You should. But what is wisdom anyway? Is wisdom being smart? Not necessarily. Wisdom has nothing to do with being smart or intelligent. Wisdom has to do with how you apply things, okay? The choices you make have to do with wisdom more than smarts. I know some people that are, you know, book smart. They're brilliantly smart. They could do math or science or this or that very well. And they got, we used to say they have no common sense. In other words, they had no wisdom, okay? And so you have to find that balance between intellect and wisdom, all right? All right, let's go to Diane.
Yeah, see, my question is on Psalm 119. You recently made a comment that everybody should read that on a regular basis. And when I read it, I was struck by a theme in there, and I wanted to ask you about it. It says, blessed are those who observe his witnesses. I have rejoiced in the way of your witnesses. Your witnesses are my delight. I have clung to your witnesses and inclined my heart to your witnesses, that I might speak of your witnesses. And my question is on the witnesses.
Right.
My first thought was that it was probably referring to the 613 commandments. But after kind of researching it, I kind of thought I couldn't quite put that in a box. The writer of Psalm 119 says in verse 88, it says, revive me according to your loving commitment, that I might guard the witness of your mouth. And I kind of thought that was key to unlocking what these witnesses are, that it's the witness of Yahweh's mouth. So, you know, I was also watching Are You Covenanted Monday night, and a covenant you also defined as a witness. So, you know, with Yahweh's mouth, he speaks many, many things to us. So I also uncovered that witness can also be defined as a testimony. So I'm thinking that the whole book is his witness to us of who he is and who he wants us to be. So I think my first thought was too narrow in that I needed to expand it to include more things than just the 613 commandments. So I wanted your thought on that.
Okay. So first of all, I think your conclusion at the end was correct. Okay.
Okay.
I'm a little... I don't know if the word is concerned. I'm curious as to when you said you did research, what that meant.
Well, I looked at the word, first of all, to see what it was. And it really struck me that it was the word Adah.
I'm not going to ask you for all the details of your research. I was curious. So you went about looking at the definition of the word and what the Hebrew was and that kind of thing. Okay, but the reason I'm asking is because I'm curious if when, and I want people to hear this who also may do the same thing. If you find something you're not sure about, just I want to caution you about how you go about trying to find the answer. Because you could look up the Hebrew or the Greek and see if you understand the word correctly. You could see if there's a teaching that I've done that covers it or call or contact us with a question. You also could go seek what other teachers are saying about it, okay, which would be a very bad idea. Okay.
No, I don't want to do that.
No, but I'm just saying is, since you didn't say how and what you did for research, I waited to see what conclusion you came to, which was actually a good conclusion. Which, by the way, I have taught many times in other teachings, the idea of the witness is the thing that you said at the end, which is it's a testimony about all that he has done and that all that he said he would do have that he did and all the things he said that he would do that haven't happened yet. And that's the witness. Okay.
I like that.
Okay. And so your conclusion at the end is correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And good job looking up the word and trying to understand the different meanings. And that was good. All right. So you can leave
well,
the...
If I,
What? Do you have another?
If I might say one last thing. The word witness, Adah, is also the same word for congregation. And I just want to say that your congregation, the witness of who you are is just fantastic. And I appreciate the witness that you are to Cleveland, Tennessee, as well as to the online community. So thank you very much for your witness.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
So generally speaking, in the secular world, what do witnesses do? Witnesses are giving their testimony about what they observed or experienced about something that happened. And so that's what the witnesses are that are being talked about here in Psalm 119. All the things that were observed and happened, these are all the witnesses. So it's not the 613 commandments, although part of the witness was the giving of the commandments. Okay? So the whole event we're reading about now, or journeying in Exodus towards coming to Sinai, is part of the witness. The plagues were part of the witness. The garden and the two trees was part of the witness, right? All these things are witnesses to who and what he is and what he did and what he's doing, okay? And so David appreciated those things, helped to give us an understanding of how to relate to the creator of the universe. And so that's a beautiful thing. All right, let's go to, let's see, Melton. You're looking a little green.
I'm sorry, Rev. I don't know how to work this thing. That could.
That's okay. We can hear you, though. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rabbi Steve, for all you do. You've been my NICE for 3 years. I've been following you, and I find your teachings very informational. I enjoy them quite a bit.
Good.
My question is, in the scriptures, it says that every man has died, has passed, but it says that Enoch walked with the Lord, and then Enoch was no more. He was taken up with the Lord, and Elijah as well. Would I be correct or incorrect? I'm assuming to think that these two, I know you don't do much revelation teachings, but could these two possibly be the two end time witnesses?
Well, that's a very common, you know, theory. Okay. And by the way, when he for anybody who's new, when he referred to me as Nasi, Nasi would be the leader over the leaders, like the head of the Sanhedrin was called the Nasi. Okay. And since I do actually, not only am I the rabbi of this group, but we have the other congregations around the world that would, so presiding over all of that would make me use the term, you know, the title Nasi as appropriate. All right. So look, we don't know who the two witnesses are. And certainly, I think it's easy to speculate that Enoch and Elijah never died. I don't know that that's actually true. And I don't, it just says that they were taken from where they were. Personally, I think they were taken to like Hawaii and they're enjoying the rest of their lives and, you know, or something like that. No, the thing is, it doesn't say what Christianity or others might say. It says that Enoch was no more. That's all it tells us, okay? And Elijah was taken up, but where did he go, okay? So there's not a whole lot of information. And so that's all we know. What we do need to understand is the two men that you just mentioned, Enoch, number one, walked with. Walked with means he was keeping covenant and he had that relationship vertically, okay? There's not a lot of people that are talked about. Abraham was one of them, walked with, okay? You don't get a lot of walked withs in scripture. That's a high praise from above. And then Elijah, we know who Elijah was. We got a lot more detail. It doesn't say a whole lot. It's like two verses that mention Enoch, okay? But there's a whole lot more we get to read about Elijah and what he did and things that he didn't and his relationship, you know, vertically and the things he accomplished as a prophet, okay? So, and then, of course, he gets taken away to make room then for Elisha. And so there was a passing literally of the mantle there, right? So could they be the two witnesses? I believe that there will be witnesses, certainly in the spirit of, just like we were told that there would be one coming in the spirit of Elijah, And then Yeshua tells her that, Yochanan the immerser, right? That John the Baptist was that, just in that spirit, was that same concept, right? And of course, that doesn't mean he's the ultimate fulfillment. Maybe there's going to be something more in the future. So I would not be surprised that whoever it is, at least is functioning in a spiritual, similar way, okay, as Enoch and Elijah, all right? Also, maybe even like John, because John certainly, whoever these witnesses are at the end, are guys who are not afraid of anything. They're going to stand up there and just say what has to be said. They're the ones who are going to be pointing at the false Messiah going, he ain't it. You guys need to repent. That's not the Messiah. And that's going to get them killed and resurrected 3 days later. But it's going to get them killed. Okay? So whoever it is, you know, and my wife gets nervous when I talk about this because she's thinking, it better not be you. You better not be one of them. Because she knows I'm not afraid to say anything. Okay, I'll say whatever it is. And I don't care, you know, whatever that is. I'm open to whatever he has me to do. I'm not claiming to be anything. People are going to get all messed up with that. We don't know, okay, who the two witnesses are, all right? There are people that will claim that they're metaphorical. They're not actually two beings, but like two groups of people, okay? Because the two houses, Israel in the north and Judah in the south, could be looked at as two witnesses. But I believe they're going to be two people who are going to be standing in Jerusalem making the statements, and then they're going to get killed, all right? Who are they? Unknown. What will they be like? I think they'll be like those guys, like an Enoch and Elijah. We really don't really know much about how Enoch was, but Enoch was one of the only ones righteous when everybody else was terrible, okay, right before the flood. So,
yes, sir.
You know, okay, does that answer the question?
Yes, sir, it does, yes. All right. Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, and you can go ahead and put your hand down and leave the room. Okay, next up we have, let's see, let's go to Anna. I know you just popped in, but you get sort of semi-daughter privileges.
Aw, thank you so much. All right, can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, awesome. So my question is, there's obviously like a lot of craziness happening in our world, a lot of crazy world events. And I'm just wondering, with all this horrible stuff, whether it's the end times or not, how do we choose to have a positive perspective towards light? I know like some people, and I know I've struggled with this in the past, where it's just like all these events come up, and it's easy to have this depressed perspective and not have any hope for the future. So, yeah.
All right, good question, and you probably weren't up early enough for the Zone 2 meeting, but I did say nice things about you, okay, because there was a young man who was in high school that was making a stand to do these things, and I said, well, I know a young lady when she was in high school did a few things like that, and so I gave you some accolades there, okay, and I mentioned your choice to with the cross-country skiing and the whole thing. All right, so the point is this. Listen to teaching, peace in a world not his. Remind yourself about it, because that teaching was literally the answer to this question, all right? It is very hard to deal with life. Life is really challenging. It goes up and down. Lots of times it goes down. And knowing what to do with that, and the best way we deal with that is by knowing, okay, the cure for most emotional problems, I always say this is what? Reality, okay? Those of you who have counseled, you know, the cure for most things is reality. So what's the reality? He's got it under control. It doesn't matter what it looks like. He has it under control. It will all work out in the end. Okay? All things work for the good. Okay? So we have to embrace, when the more we see things that are disturbing, the more we have to remind ourselves that it's okay. These things have to happen. Look, Matthew 24, Yeshua describes a lot of terrible things. And he said, look, these things have to happen. Okay? And so, and we're not even in terrible times compared to what some of the times we've already been through over the last, you know, 6,000 years. This is not the worst of times, okay? These are pretty good times, all things considered. But we get nervous because in our limited lifespan, maybe it's worse than it was when we were younger or whatever, so we don't have any perspective, okay? It's very hard to have perspective being such a short-lived being, you know? I mean, we got 6,000 years of history here in the scriptures, or 4,000 in the scriptures, 2,000 since then, and we lived to only be maybe 100 years old, most people in the 70s to 90s range. That's a really small number in the, you know, the spectrum. So how much can you remember an experience, okay? And you're young. Okay, I can remember some things because I'm 60 now, and I can see some of the worth. There was a lot of times in my last 60 years that things were worse than they are now. There were also some times where they're better, okay? And I've seen it kind of roller coaster around. So what you have to combat all this is remember, he has it under control, all right? Now, he's also allowing it to get out of control. But in the same time, he still has it under control, meaning he's going to only allow it to get to so far, then Yeshua comes, and then, you know, we go to the next step, okay? But he has this all planned. He knows what's going to happen, knows the end from the beginning. So we have to consistently, you know, reaffirm to ourselves, it's all going on the way he wants it to go, or the way he's allowing it to go, it's okay. No matter what we're watching, it's okay. It's his plan. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. So you can also leave the room. Let's go to Lily. Looks like Zone 1, South Dakota.
We're from California, San Diego, California.
Oh, San Diego. SD for San Diego. Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's no problem.
I actually have two questions. One I posted online when all the things were going on with the Zoom. But my first question, and I guess I'll get out and then come back and let somebody else come in. But my first question, I am actually studying under your 613 commandments, and I have made it to part 17.
Oh, almost finished.
Almost. I have a question on commandment 239. It says, Leviticus 19:17b. It says, you shall rebuke someone who has done evil regardless of age. My question is, how does this relate with taking the plant out of our own eye and minding our own business?
All right. Okay, I don't think I said it on that teaching necessarily because I can't remember. That's a long time ago already. The thing that you have to remember about correction, because rebuking is basically correction. And I have said this on many teachings, okay? Correction must come out of appropriate relationship. In other words, you can't just correct anybody, okay? So that's the plank and twig thing, is people just randomly trying to correct everybody. If I'm a parent, I have a right relationship to correct my child, okay? I don't have a right relationship necessarily to correct your child, or you for that matter. If I'm your rabbi, I may have the right relationship with you to correct you, okay? So it really comes out of relationship. Does that make sense now? So when you're reading the verse in Leviticus, you know, it says, do not take vengeance or bear grudge against the children of the people. I'm sorry, that's 18. Guard my laws, do not let your livestock. Oh, where am I? What verse did you say it was? Oh, verse 19, 17.
17.
Right. Do not hate your brother in your heart, reprove your neighbor for certain, and bear no sin because of him. Now, did we miss the last part of the verse? And bear no sin because of him. So I'm going to guess, this goes to what I was just reading about this revelation I gave all you guys about being influenced. Somebody is trying to influence you, which may cause you to bear sin, and you rebuke that person and say, no, okay? That's not what we should be doing. That would also, again, come out of a right relationship, okay? But all correction is relational based. You cannot correct those you do not have the right relationship to correct. Which is why I know this is going to get me in unpopular more than whatever. You cannot correct vertically. You can't correct up. Some of you are not going to like that. You think, oh, you just don't want anybody to ever. No, you cannot correct above you. Period. Okay? But people try to do that. You can have a discussion. You could say, I don't understand why you're doing certain things, and that look for clarification, but you cannot correct. A child doesn't correct the parent, because that's correcting up, okay? You don't correct your employer, that's correcting up. You can go to your employer and ask your employer, listen, I think there's a problem or whatever I want to talk to you about, but you don't correct those above you. Okay? You have to have a position of above to correct below. So this is where we get into the wrong relationships, because you have a husband and wife. It's really husband-wife. Wife does this and tries to correct the husband. Now we got a problem. Child, parent. Child does this to try to correct the parent. Okay? You have to have a right relationship. And you got to understand that. Okay, does that help with the verse?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, if you're done, you can go ahead and leave the room and just watch us on YouTube. All right, let's go to...